We have 535 voting members of Congress, 9 justices on the Supreme Court, and just 1 president in American government. And you know which person gets the most attention? The president. Frequently, the things that lead us to call presidents of our party strong leaders often lead us to call presidents of the other party tyrants. Our guest this hour takes the analysis beyond party and person to the office itself. How strong should the presidency be in the United States? There's a lot of ongoing debate about that. Peter M. Shane takes up the issue in the soon-to-be-published book, Democracy's Chief Executive, Interpreting the Constitution and Defining the Future of the Presidency. Peter Shane is Professor Emeritus of Law at Ohio State University and a scholar of constitutional law with a focus on separation of powers and the place where law, democracy, and new media meet. He writes frequent op-eds, as has written several previous books. Peter Shane, a pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Not your first book on this subject either, I notice. Is there a long history of mission creep for the presidency?
There is a long history of mission creep. And I suppose one of the themes of the book is that it's a kind of bipartisan one-way ratchet, which is to say not every president has exactly the same theories for why the presidency should be yet more powerful, and the increasing ambition of the presidency accelerates at different rates under different presidents, but it at least since the New Deal, the direction has been entirely upward. So since the New Deal and World War II, we've just seen a kind of steady increase in really the operational priority of the presidency over the other branches.
And one basic question is why? I mean, the people who like strong presidents in their party do realize they have to put up with strong presidents from the other party, right?
Well, that's a very good question. I often think, when you hear people speak about these issues, particularly, if I may say so, outside the academy, there doesn't seem to be a complete appreciation of the fact that one party will not be in permanent power, and indeed the peaceful and readily anticipated exchange of partisan control is itself supposed to be one of the checks on presidential ambition. It hasn't much worked that way, and there are a number of factors. I mean, one factor, quite frankly, is that Congress has become increasingly polarized over the years. They have greater and greater difficulty agreeing on limits. They don't want to limit presidents of their own party. They don't want to cooperate at all with presidents of the other party. And with regard to some difficult decision-making, at the same time, even though this seems paradoxical, they're willing to allow the president to interpret existing statutory authority, and to some extent even his constitutional authority, very broadly, so that they can point to the president if things go wrong. And you certainly see that most extensively, I suppose, with regard to foreign policy and war powers. If you look at the text of the Constitution, there's an awful lot in Article 1, which is the article about the legislative branch, that suggests that they must really be controlling what's going on with the military, because they make decisions with regarding the raising of armies, the support of the Navy. Going back to the way things were done in the 18th century, they had control over what were called letters of marque and reprisal. These really had to do with to allow private forces to be involved in military operations on behalf of the United States without being accused of piracy. They provide for the regulation of the armed services. They provide for the discipline of the militia when in federal service. So all of this would make, and of course they have the power to declare war. And yet, unless the president is intent on starting a conflict that will yield a massive and prolonged land war, something, I suppose, like Korea all over again, or even Vietnam at this stage, it's generally conceded, or at least it's generally claimed by the president, that the president gets to decide where and when to deploy military force when it's in the interest of the United States to do so. And Congress has not, it has not at all in the last 20 years stepped up to put any kind of limits on those claims of presidential authority.
You say that the expansion of presidential authority is not just annoying but dangerous. How?
Well, it's dangerous because, well, I always say this to my students. Let me back up a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So in thinking about this, we might imagine a healthy presidency being in the hands of someone who is trying to, at any moment, do the most good for the most people. Not just the people who supported his or her party in the last election, but really represent all Americans. And you would expect the president's judgment about that to be kind of well-educated by a sense of where public sentiment lies on a variety of issues. And this is why it would be conventional wisdom, really, until through the 1970s, that presidents, however they campaign, would tend to govern towards the center because they're trying to attract the support and meet the views and needs of the median voter. Right now, we have a presidency that is not at all guaranteed to operate that way. Money has become such a big element in elections, both for president but also for members of Congress. Members of Congress themselves have become almost full-time fundraisers, and there is, as a result, enormous pressure on every member of Congress to line up with his or her party and that president. Now, you add that system, you add that on top of a nation of frequently gerrymandered districts, which really dampen competition,
mm-hmm.
and you find that people get elected who don't have to govern from the center. They can govern, you know, at the margins.
So, Peter, the point you were making when we hit the break was that polarization results in president and members of Congress playing to base, which I think that the reason you call that dangerous is because there's nobody left in the middle focusing on the needs of the vast majority of the people.
That could well be the case. And the more that a president regards him or herself entitled to wield virtually unchecked authority, not really accountable either to Congress or to the courts, you are leaving out, what used to be called maybe the silent majority. Maybe they're not silent anymore, but it may well be the majority of Americans in terms of their interests and their views.
Mm-hmm. You point out that there were really three debates taking place simultaneously, originalist versus adaptivist, presidentialists versus constitutional pluralists, and then the highly centralized versus shared power. I want to come to the point of originalism. It's a big topic now. It's not original itself, is it?
No, and that's a good question. It's and it's morphed over the years. The current Supreme Court follows a view of originalism that imagines that there is some way to look at the text of the Constitution and figure out what the language would have meant to the sort of ordinary educated reader of 1789, if we're talking, or 1787, if we're talking about the original text, 1868, if we're talking about the 14th Amendment, and somehow we can go automatically from that original public meaning of the text to its application in a specific case. And there are multiple reasons why the system of interpretation doesn't work as simply as that. But one also has to say that the justices who proclaim most loudly that they are originalist in that way are pretty lousy historians. So
to put it bluntly.
Right. So frequently, they are simultaneously insisting that they are kind of restricting their own discretion to exercise policy judgment because they're bound by history, and then they pretty much ignore a great deal of the historical evidence.
Well, to one particular point with originalists, the idea that, you know, if there's no right to abortion, no right to gay marriage, et cetera, in the Constitution, then there is no such right. But then there's the Ninth Amendment that says the enumeration shall not be construed of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
Right. And of course, you know, that raises the question, what are the other rights retained by the people? But to focus on the presidency, and you can just see how slippery this resort to the language is. Justice Scalia, when he was on the court, and you know, people who support his view of the unitary presidency, start from the premise, well, Article 2 of the Constitution vests all executive power in the president. But Article 2 doesn't use the word all. It just says that the executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States. And it's not as if the word all doesn't appear other places in the Constitution. One of the places it appears is in what's called the Necessary and Proper Clause with regard to congressional authority. Congress is allowed to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution, you know, for implementing all the powers that the Constitution vests in any officer or branch of government. So if you're looking for who is supreme by counting the number of times the word all is used, Congress would seem to have more to say about the exercise of executive power than the unilateral party seems to admit.
All right. So obviously, one of the major points for talking about the power of the presidency comes from Donald Trump's time. You have pointed out that the expansion of power begins with the FDR and the New Deal, but you spent a lot of time as well in the Reagan and Bush years, Reagan and Bush 1, and Bush 2, I guess, for that matter, too. But the Department of Justice under in the Reagan and Bush years, I mean, that's where the term unitary executive, as I can see, first got used a lot. I get the concept, but not the wording. What does that mean, unitary executive? Sorry if I sound like Tucker Carlson asking questions.
That's quite all right. I think the resemblance can stop there. the idea is that, and this is pretty much as it's been expressed by people like former Attorney General Bill Barr, that the executive power in the Constitution, according to this theory, is vested in its entirety in the single individual who is the president. So obviously there's an executive branch of government, but the way the executive branch is structured is left entirely to Congress. The only executive branch members created by the Constitution are the president and vice president. And the vice president's only specified duty is actually to preside over the Senate. So the inference that the unitary presidency theorists draw is that all of the exercise of executive power that happens within our constitutional system must be within the control of the single individual in the White House. The president, there are different nuances, different variations, depending on which theorist you're talking about. The most extreme version would say that any time Congress empowers an agency to do anything, the president, if the president wants, could just do it himself. So the president sees that Congress has given power to the Environmental Protection Agency to decide how to regulate pollution, the president could say, you know, I'm going to make those rules. That's kind of an extreme version of this. A less extreme version, and probably the most common version, is that anybody who makes any kind of policy decision within the executive branch, again, this is according to the unitary executive folks, anybody who has that authority must be fireable at will by the president. And the president must be able to command how that person exercises whatever their legal authority is on pain of discharge if the president decides to do so. Again, this... Historically, I suppose an interesting feature of this is that what we've seen since the 1980s is a kind of ideological reversal in who is arguing for what position. The argument for the president gets to fire anybody he wants in the New Deal would have been the New Dealer's position. That would have been Franklin Roosevelt's position. And it was rejected by the Supreme Court in a 9-0 opinion called Humphrey's Executor versus the United States. Nine members of the court all agreeing on one opinion, including some of the most distinguished justices of the entire history of the country. But now the theory of the unitary presidency is really associated with judicial conservatives. That, and by conservative, I mean conservative in the sense of right-wing. Since the Reagan administration, the idea that the president should be able to control anything has really been pushed most vigorously by the Republican Party. The difference, though, between the Democrats and Republicans is not so much how the presidents have operated, although Trump is something of an outlier in terms of how extreme his ambition was. But Democratic presidents have not so much pushed the idea that the Constitution guarantees them unreviewable authority. They tend more to read their statutory authority broadly, but presidents Reagan, Bush 41, Bush 43, and certainly the lawyers of the Trump administration have really argued that it's the Constitution that guarantees, it supposedly guarantees the president this extraordinary, I can fire whoever I want, authority. You may remember the, Donald Trump saying rather remarkably, there's this thing called Article 2, which nobody seems to talk about, that allows me to do whatever I want. And I think he meant it literally.
It sure seems that way. We were talking to Peter Shane, a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and a scholar of constitutional law. He actually testified at the Kavanaugh hearing against the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. He's the author of Democracy's Chief Executive, Interpreting the Constitution and Defining the Future of the Presidency. It's a conversation that is ongoing in America, and you're welcome to take part in it right here, right now on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it sounds like whether it's found in the Constitution or found in statutes, you've got both parties doing similar things, a reluctance to challenge the president's powers, and presidents more than willing to use the powers their parties find.
I think it has largely evolved in that direction. And it's interesting. I was my first job after law school and a judicial clerkship was working in the Justice Department during the latter years of the Carter administration. And Jimmy Carter, of course, is a Democratic president. The Democrats were in control of both houses of Congress. The chair of the very powerful House Commerce Committee at that time was a member of the House named John Dingell, if you're a connoisseur of these things, a very famous member of Congress.
Long-serving member, yeah.
Very long-serving, who was notorious for the intensity with which he took his oversight responsibilities. He was very demanding of information from the executive branch so that he could determine whether, by his committee's lights, the agencies were doing the jobs that they were assigned to do. His requests for information were typically called within the executive branch dinglegrams, which, and people, feared them in a certain sense because it would be a very, very extensive search for the material, and it could be a fight over what's going to be shared. But he was no less demanding of Jimmy Carter than he had been of Ronald Reagan, than he had been of Richard Nixon, would be of Ronald Reagan. And that kind of attitude towards oversight, which is, I'm going to make sure that the agencies under my committee's jurisdiction are doing their job, whether it's my party in power or the other party in power, has pretty much dissipated. I don't want to say it never occurs, but you just don't see it with the same kind of intensity.
Well, so then take up the issue of the House Ways and Means Committee wanting to get its hands on the Donald Trump tax returns while he was in the White House, and give the logic, as you understand it, to the executive and the Department of Justice response to that request from the House.
Well, there is a statute that explicitly allows the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee to make the request that was made, and the Justice Department issued a rather remarkable opinion to the Secretary of the Treasury that said that in the face of this the plain language of the statute, the executive branch could make a determination of its own whether there was a legitimate purpose for the demand or whether it was politically pretextual, to use their language. And if the Secretary of the Treasury were satisfied that the demand was politically motivated and not within congressional authority, he could resist it. This is completely made up. I mean, you know, this is cut from whole cloth completely. There's nothing in the statute that creates any such authority. Now, opinions like this are not, you know, authored by the Attorney General himself or herself sitting down with pen and paper. There's an office that handles them called the Office of Legal Counsel. And the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, handles a lot of these issues because they really arise in the executive branch before they come up in court, and sometimes they never come up in court. In this case, and it doesn't happen all that often, when the Biden administration came in, the Office of Legal Counsel issued an opinion that said our predecessors in this office got it wrong, that under the statute, the statutory language means what it says, that whether or not there's, you know, political motivation behind something Congress does, Congress is entitled to the respect that is entailed in the kind of a constitutional authority it wields, and the presumption has to be that when a demand is made consistent with the letter of the statute, that it needs to be obeyed. So now, obviously, there's been a change, right, from the Republican administration to a Democratic administration. But, of course, President Biden must know, Attorney General Garland must know, the head of the Office of Legal Counsel must know, that if a Republican House Ways and Means chairman wants President Biden's tax returns, he will now be able to use the same power. But that didn't stop them. They still said what I think is the correct thing, which is the letter of the statute had to be followed.
So the Office of the Legal Counsel, OLC, does seem to be the hammer very often in expanding presidential power. It was OLC that rendered the opinion, I forget which, was it one of the Bushes it was under, that said that the president can't be charged with a crime while in office?
Well, there were two opinions of that kind. One was an opinion issued during the Nixon administration, and another was issued during the Clinton administration. One has to say that the arguments in both of those opinions are not entirely persuasive.
Well, so then talk about where things go from here. Do you find any champions of unitary executive pulling back, maybe William Barr himself, after the experience with Donald Trump and his I can do whatever I want under Article 2 claim?
Absolutely not. I don't see any of that pullback. And more remarkably, I think the supporters of President Trump in Congress would give him the benefit of the same theory should he find himself back in office. I do want to say among academics, there are differences of opinion even within the unitary presidency camp about how far it goes. And a friend of mine, you know, these are serious scholars. They're not, to quote Supreme Court justices, they're not just partisan hacks. They're serious legal scholars. And one of the most interesting is a fellow at the University of Virginia named Sai Prakash, because he does believe in the unitary presidency when it comes to domestic authority, although, again, there's some nuance there. But he also believes that if you were a serious originalist, that Congress has just given the president a scope of war-making power that he regards as utterly inconsistent with 1787. And, you know, a lawyer named John Yoo, who's a law professor at Berkeley.
The torture memo.
Best known for the author of the torture memos. I mean, has argued to the contrary, that the founding generation thought the president could send the military anywhere and everywhere, and that all Congress could do was cut off appropriations if they disagreed. Historians and legal scholars generally are entirely on the side of Professor Prakash on this. So On the war powers, there is some pushback.
We were just talking about the power of the president to wage war, and there has been no formal declaration of war by Congress since the Second World War. That leads us into a question from Rio in Little River. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. My question for Mr. Shane is, ever since the onset of the age of nuclear weapons, the president has had the ultimate power to decide whether or not to use them. So what does this say about the power of the office of the president and the state of the democracy in this country, or lack thereof?
All right. Thanks, Rio, for that.
Your listener describes the situation accurately, and it is a perfect example where Congress has really not created a kind of legislative framework to lead to kind of orderly decision-making with regard to the use of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons could conceivably be thought about in different contexts. You could imagine a situation, I mean, one hesitates to imagine it, but imagine that the United States were subject to a nuclear attack with missiles incoming, unanticipated or not much anticipated, and that the president has to act immediately. Well, in that kind of situation, I think presidents, it's well understood, have the constitutional authority to respond to defend the United States, just as they would have had the authority in 1789 to respond to a land invasion. But often, again, as you think about the possible scenarios, the more likely, and I want to think that none of these things are likely, but the more likely scenario would be either there's a kind of ratcheting up of tension between the United States and a nuclear adversary. So the president is thinking, not, you know, I'm going to launch on this date and this time, but, you know, they're thinking that might be necessary. They can kind of anticipate this. Or even a president is thinking preemptively about using nuclear weapons to prevent some threat against the United States.
So
in those situations, there is enough time for a kind of structured decision-making process to occur. There's a quite good book about the presidency with a Republican and a Democratic co-author. It's called After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. It's by Bob Bauer, who is a former White House counsel under President Obama, and Jack Goldsmith, who is a former head of the Office of Legal Counsel under George W. Bush. Jack Goldsmith now teaches at Harvard, Bob Bowers at NYU, and they lay out a very strong case why a kind of legislative framework is desirable and available for at least having more legitimate deliberation, more careful democratic input in the use of the potential use of strategizing about nuclear weapons than we now have. So far, nobody in Congress seems to be running with that ball.
And it's so interesting, too, that Congress is willing to cede that kind of power. The first part of your book basically asks the question, if the president won't follow norms, who can make him? And what do you find to be the question at the moment?
Right. So President Trump, and again, I don't want this to sound like the analysis is just an anti-Trump analysis, but he took so many of the ideas that others had played with in one form and just sort of carried them out to such an extreme that he has taught future presidents a lesson. And it's not a great lesson for the country. The lesson is that delay and obstruction can get you a lot of what you want. That if you were, you know, Richard Nixon, if he had played by those rules, would have served an entire 8 years in all likelihood. But Republicans in the Senate, Barry Goldwater, for example, went to the president and said, you know, we're not going to stand behind you after you've covered up this burglary. But if the Republicans in Congress had thought differently, and President Nixon just decided to drag things out, you know, interminably, he could have gotten to the end of his term. And certainly, you know, if Watergate happened today, that's what you would see. When the question is often asked, you know, and I think you started the hour in a way by asking, does the presidency today look like what the founding generation imagined? And the answer is no, but not just in the sense that they had a clear sense of the presidency, and it's not like that. It's more that the entire world has changed. When the folks in Philadelphia sat down and described the presidency and the Constitution, you know, they were looking at George Washington in front of the room, and pretty much they were thinking, we trust him. he'd be a good commander-in-chief. We'll give him the executive power. And we're talking about an executive branch of government that by 1800 probably didn't have many more employees than the smallest cabinet department does in 2022. The Department of Veterans Affairs probably has more people working for it this year than the entire federal government had at the start of the 19th century. So when you ask, you know, does the presidency today look like what the framers imagined, I think sensibly we shouldn't just ask, did the framers think that George Washington would be allowed to fire any of the 3,000 people working for the federal government? The question is, do we want a single human being to have that much power over 2 million civilian employees of the federal government, most of whom the president couldn't pick out of a lineup and probably certainly doesn't understand, has little understanding of their actual intended statutory function? It is utterly anachronistic to ask the question.
You know, you touched on an area that I did wonder about, and that was like how easy was it to design a presidency when you had George Washington standing in front of you, and everybody's like, oh, George will do right by us. But, you know, not thinking about the likes of, say, I don't know, John Tyler or Franklin Pierce or Donald Trump in the office instead.
So this is not a thought entirely original to me by any means, but I think, and this goes to the importance of norms, the single greatest service that George Washington may have performed for the citizens of the United States is voluntarily leaving office at the end of a second term. This was, you know, utterly unheard of at the time. And, except for January 6, 2021, established a norm that, as I should also say, under FDR, he did not stop at two terms. He undoubtedly thought it was based on a national emergency, and going to the fourth term was in the middle of World War II. But that norm of peaceful transition and handing it over to someone who, you know, might not at all be of the same political philosophy, that has been an invaluable safeguard of the quality of life in the United States.
And as a precedent that obviously became enshrined in the Constitution later on after FDR.
Right.
Let me ask you a question that kind of gets outside the fine-pointed legal stuff that you're very good at, Peter, which is more broadly, and I mean outside the framework of government, what is your read on American thinking and desire for a strong president? I mean, people always talk about major things in American law as President X did this and President Y did that. Never Congress did this and they signed it.
This is true. And just picking up on an observation I think you made earlier, which I agree with, which is people generally want their presidents, the president that they voted for, to be high in initiative, ambitious, and effective, and somebody elected from the other party to be cautious, respectful, and restrained. And to some extent, that, you know, we have a system in which you need to play by the same set of rules, whichever party is in control, if we're going to have anything that deserves to be called a government of laws. I think that presidents, and this is a very large ask, I understand that. But I do think that unless we have more Americans who understand and become engaged with the intricacies of government, not just at the national level, but even at the local and state level, in a way that is open to listening to other people, to thinking pragmatically about problems, not just ideologically about problems, it's very hard to imagine a political atmosphere in which the presidency could return to a more checked and balanced entity. Right now, given the hyper-polarization that we're experiencing, the rewards for a president respecting norms, I mean, again, think, you know, President Biden clearly intended that one of the themes of his administration to be, you know, I'm the fellow who knows how to cooperate with the other side. I can reach across the aisle. We can get things done. Since the big infrastructure bill, haven't seen that very much. And people in Congress are responding to the political incentives that they see in their own home districts, where if you're rewarded more for party loyalty than for actual accomplishment, you know, presidents are going to eventually look for ways to get things done on their own.
It brings up the Obama claim. It's like, I got a telephone and I got a pen, and I'll do what I can do within the limits of what I can do, but obviously pushing the boundaries there as well. So Peter, ultimately, do you think we need to have more laws written or amendments made to the Constitution to more greatly define, describe, proscribe presidential power?
I think one could imagine laws that would be helpful. Certainly a revised version of the War Powers Resolution, an updating of the authority that the president has or does not have with regard to anti-terrorism activity around the globe. These would be very useful things. It would be good to have a better structure for policing corruption within the executive branch if it existed, more protection for whistleblowers than currently happens. As far as constitutional amendments, it would be nice, and I think I've probably gotten to the point where I would take seriously a proposal to elect an attorney general separately from the president. This is the way it operates in virtually every state. That was considered a kind of radical proposal back in the 70s, but now I think we've seen there's some danger when the president and the attorney general are too closely aligned personally and politically. But the thing that is hardest, is for people to take seriously and not just ideologically their own role as a responsible citizen and someone, you know, willing to, you know, weigh in even against the president of his or her own party if you see that the person is just not behaving the way that they should. And if I could just sort of make one further point, because you mentioned President Obama before. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because presidents know that they're being judged for things, they make the situation worse by rhetorically making it sound like they're actually accomplishing more than they are. So when many a journalist called me after the executive branch adopted the deferred action for
DACA,
DACA program, mm-hmm. asking about President Obama's order creating that program. There was no such order. It came out of the Department of Homeland Security. It was the secretary's order, but the president's rhetoric made it sound like it was him doing it. And you can hear presidents do that all the time.
Yeah, and of course the public always, you know, does what I said too, where it's like, you know, so-and-so passed this, so-and-so passed that. And it's not really like that, as we learn and are reminded in Democracy's Chief Executive, Interpreting the Constitution and Defining the Future of the Presidency by Peter M. Shane. Peter, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Oh, thanks for your time and questions.
All right, take care.